In John chapter 4, it's one of my favorite chapters. This was very close to my heart when everything happened in New York City, 911. Because it shows Jesus in a very real, down-to-earth way in touching a person's life. Jesus, it says here, when the Lord knew that the Pharisees had heard that Jesus made and baptized more disciples than John, though Jesus himself didn't baptize, but his disciples, he left Judea and departed again to Galilee, but he needed to go through Samaria. Now the Lord knew that the Pharisees heard. They'd heard that this guy was even more popular than John. And of course, the Pharisees had an attitude against John the Baptist. They felt that he wasn't of God, although they didn't want to come right out and say that because the people followed John. And the Pharisees, being good religious politicians, carefully had their hand on the pulse of what the people felt. Though they, you know, didn't agree with them, they wouldn't dare speak against John because the people thought he was a prophet. But now Jesus heard the scuttlebutt that the Pharisees are talking about Jesus. Hey, he's got more disciples than John the Baptist. And so he knows that his popularity is growing, and he's not interested in getting into a political confrontation with them. In fact, you know, you got to understand, no matter what happens as a Christian, the system will never be on your side. It just won't be. Religious system or otherwise, it's not going to be a friend to those who are truly following after God. You've got to understand that. It's hard for us to accept that because we think when our eyes were open to see Jesus into who he is, everybody should see this. What's wrong with you? You know, and you come at your husband or your wife or your friends and they don't understand. They think you've gotten into some cult or some weird thing and they can't see the simplicity of the gospel for all the formality of religion that covers it. Jesus saw this. It wasn't the time. Of course, the Bible often records Jesus saying his hour had not yet come. And when he said that, of course, you know, it was an indication that there was a particular time when Jesus would reveal himself very plainly to the world that he was the Messiah. He would make the signs very clear and unmistakable. And he did that when he presented himself in Jerusalem on a donkey, fulfilling a prophecy in Zechariah. And the people, who, if they read their Bibles, they would have recognized it. I wonder how many people would recognize it today who say they're Christians, but they don't know their Bibles. They don't know what the truth of God is. But Jesus was not going to go down that road. You know, he's not going to make that political confrontation. So he departs and goes to Galilee. Now, leaving Judea in the south, going to Galilee in the north, in between those two lands is Samaria. And that area is called Samaria. Just want to make sure you're with me here. That was a real groaner, I know. I could tell. It's always lovely to watch your reaction. I get more of a kick out of it, I got to tell you. But Jesus needed to go through Samaria. Now, most of the religious leaders, believe it or not, would actually, because of their prejudice of the people, would go around that entire area to avoid meeting any of the Samaritans who were considered in that day, you know, half-breeds. They would be called, you know, mixed among the nations. They were mixed a lot of the religion and with a lot of the pagan, you know, religions. And it was just a big mixture. They had a little bit of truth. They knew about Jehovah, but they kind of twisted things. And it goes back into the history, into the time of when the Assyrians actually took the people of that northern tribes away and planted people from other lands in that nation. And then the other people from the other lands felt they had to learn how to worship the God of Jehovah, and they tried, but they didn't get it quite right. They tried, but they didn't get it quite right. And they worshiped as was, you know, convenient to them, and as many people do, they eventually adjust their religion to make it livable in a very practical way, rather than finding out what is it that God really wants me to know. So he goes now, and he's not going to be worried about those prejudices. He goes through Samaria, and he comes to a city of Samaria, which is called Sychar, near the plot of ground that Jacob gave to his son Joseph. Now Jacob's well was there. Jesus, therefore, being wearied from his journey, sat thus by the well. And it was about the sixth hour. Now, the amazing thing is, in this setup, he's coming to this well. It's about noon. And at that time, a woman of Samaria comes to draw water, and Jesus says to her, "Give me a drink." And then it tells us in verse 8, "For his disciples had gone away into the city to buy food." So get the picture here. They've come, they're tired from the journey. It's still a long way to go. They've traveled for, you know, about 50, 60 miles on foot. Now they've got another, you know, long period before they have to get to the other place. So they're weary. It's a tiresome thing. Now picture the disciples now going in for food. Now the thing I love about this is he who could feed 5,000 with just a little lunch, he could work a miracle to supply his own needs. He never used his power. He never, you know, he was not so spiritual, and he reeked of super spirituality. There was nothing eccentric about him. He lived just like we lived. In that culture, he lived just like a normal person would live. When he used his power, it was on behalf of others for healing, as was particularly a literal fulfillment of what the Messiah would do, that he would take upon him all of their sorrows and pains and griefs, that you would know that's the Messiah. That's why he did the miracles. It was a fulfillment of prophecy. But he didn't do it for himself. He didn't just, you know, like there's some apocryphal books that speak about Jesus when he was a young boy. He made little paper doves and then let them go and they turned into real doves. And he did these types of miracles. When you read those types of books, they're all fanciful makeups of people that fancy Jesus using his power for himself. He never did it. He was very down to earth. And I love this chapter so much because it shows Jesus in a very normal, everyday life situation, and how Jesus actually reached an entire city with one woman. And it's a powerful example to me that it's not the big things that count so often. You know, we want to put on a big show in our flesh. You know, we want to really show, man, this is cool. This is what we can do. Jesus could have, but he didn't. He chose through very down-to-earth means to reach people right where they were without all the fanfare and all the hype and all the big Christendom picture. You know, he just did it down to earth. So a woman comes to draw water about the sixth hour, about noon. Jesus said to her, "Give me a drink." This passage especially came alive, as I mentioned, about in our own nation in September 11th, because the thought of how we can reach a lot of these people in New York City, how can it be done? And, you know, I really realize it was a sense of destiny. Even as Jesus is here in Samaria at this particular time, meeting this particular woman, it was a divine appointment, as we'll see. So it was for a lot of our experiences that we had with this whole New York thing. And I mean, it just happened that day that Amir, the tour guide from Israel, the former captain of the Israeli army, was with me to go up to the radio station that particular time to talk about Israel and peace. And it just so happened that, you know, the next day we were able to get in on a Red Cross boat going into the city. And it just so happened the following day that Brian Broderson, who was stuck in Washington, D.C., Chuck Smith's son-in-law, came up. And, you know, we joined together in ministry and went into the city. And just so happened that we were able to reach this author of this book, you know, Anchor for the Soul. And we got 5,000 free copies delivered that weekend to be used in the city. And it just so happened that after all day of ministering at Cantor Fitzgerald, you know, base in the plaza, and trying to minister to people who'd lost loved ones, that we'd heard some other people down in Union Square where, I mean, God was cooking down there in this makeshift memorial. So we went down there at about 11 o'clock at night, and just amazing how the Lord just touched individuals as we began talking to them. Felt called to go out there the next day, called the worship team. We get all the team out there on Tuesday, on September, that very next Tuesday, a week later, and thousands of people are flooding the park. And there was the typical religious outpouring, you know, the tracks and you know, the people yelling from a soapbox. And you had all kinds of it out there. But mostly there were people grieving, looking at the pictures, feeling the depth of what had happened in their world. And God just so, he spoke to my heart, this passage, because it was just, this is how we reach people. It's not about the show. It's not about the big thing. It's about an individual. So one individual at a time we began to minister to. And then the Lord opened up a unique door to take over for that crazy street musician that was on the street. And how the Lord opened, and it was a whole divine appointment. But what does Jesus do in this question with her? What is Jesus doing here? He says, give me a drink. Now, does that sound rude to you? It does in our culture, doesn't it? Give me a drink. Someone said that to you, you'd be offended. I'm sure, however, that when we read this, we'll see, far be it from that, it was actually the opposite that was taking place. He did get her attention with that statement because he's going against the same old cultural mores. You know what a more is. It's one of those things that's defined as the customs and habitual practices defined in the moral standards of a particular group. It's kind of what we all expect, you know, in a normal situation. When we walk down the street, there are certain cultural mores that you're not going to, you know, hippity-hop down the street or do hopscotch. You know, people would look at you very strangely. If you do anything out of the ordinary, it's kind of like it gets people's attention, but you can get attention for the wrong way, too. Jesus is doing something that's quite interesting. He definitely gets her attention. Anytime I'm in a public setting, you know, I look for opportunities to get someone's attention in a good way. That, you know, even if it's a fun way, just breaking the ice so that a conversation can open up, and who can tell from that conversation there might be a spiritual hunger or thirst. You know, I've often quipped about going into an elevator, and I always like to do this, you know, when you come into a crowded elevator, and I've shared this before. You get on, and instead of turning around and facing the numbers that everybody else does, you just look at them and say, I suppose you wonder why I've gathered you here today. And they you know, it gets a smile, and they groan too sometimes, but it just kind of breaks the ice, and then, you know, you begin talking with people. It's one of those things, because our life by nature, we're just afraid of people. We're so boring and dull, and we don't want to do anything out of the ordinary to be, you know, thought of as a little quirky or different. And the amazing thing is that Jesus breaks that. He does something that shocks this woman because, first of all, well, notice her response. The woman of Samaria, verse 9, said to him, how is it that you, being a Jew, first point, ask a drink from me, a Samaritan woman, second point. Two cultural mores that Jesus broke. One, he was actually a Jew talking to a Samaritan, which was very out of the ordinary. And two, he was a man speaking to a woman in public. What is he doing here? Now, again, a man speaking to a woman in public can be taken wrong by people. But what he's doing here is he's actually taking this woman who's out there at noon. And mind you, the only reason she's out there at noon would have been an obvious reason. She didn't get along with the rest of the ladies who came to draw water in the morning. And why is that? She was a worldly woman, a woman of the street, a woman who's been around. We'll find out that later. Instead of Jesus even acknowledging any of that, he elevates her by saying to her, give me a drink. What has he done? In the Eastern culture, it's like this. By asking somebody a favor in that culture, you're honoring them, because what you're doing is you're saying, I need your help. You're humbling yourself and you're needing them. In that culture, what Jesus did was something that's so amazing here. He takes this woman that everyone else would just like spit on as she walked by, or just, hold in contempt and or ignore totally, not even wanting to get near or touch her. And he elevates her to a position equal with himself, even more so. I need your help. Give me a drink. This amazes her. And of course, she's quite, you know, her attention has been got, basically. You know, Jesus shows how to speak to an individual in this encounter. And for us, when we encounter people of all shapes and sizes and backgrounds and cultures, what is it that keeps us from sharing the good news? You see, Jesus, of course, is going to give us an example. He's going to introduce this woman to the truth himself. He is the Messiah. And really, that's the same ministry we have. We are called to introduce people to the Messiah, to reconcile them to Christ. But why is it that we don't do it so often? I think, number one, it's our fear. We have a number of fears that when we attempt to try to speak or do something, we're afraid of what people are going to think of us, or whether we're not going to get it right. There's sometimes a lot of guilt involved. You know, we're feeling guilty if we don't say something, and Satan then works in us there. Sometimes it could be that we don't fully understand the gospel ourselves. You know, you can always tell if you understand something if you can put it in words. And that's the challenge. You know, if you're pressed to answer, how is it? What is it about this Jesus person? What does that mean? Could you give an answer to someone? Could you tell them what? I was asked in China over 20 years ago when I was there with a missions trip with my pastor at the time. We were in a hotel where a lot of the Chinese students would come and practice their English with the foreigners. And I remember being there. I loved that. It was so cool to be the center of, you know, these Chinese people who are just curious about Americans and English, and they would ask you all kinds of questions. And you saw the government agents standing around making sure that the questions were okay, or even would signal, you know, don't ask that question to some of the students. When they asked a question, he'd say, no, and he wouldn't let me answer it. It was quite amazing to watch this. But I remember one student comes up and says, tell me, what's the gist of the Bible? What's the point of the Bible? Now, you can't ask a better question to a pastor. You know, that's just perfect. Thank you for the setup. It's like, you know, lifting that ball up, nice assist, slam dunk. You know, let's do it. But I answered it, taking them through Genesis to Revelation, the whole basic point of the gospel, which is all about Jesus. It's from cover to cover, it's about Jesus. Whether it's in the Old Testament or not, it's all leading up to the Messiah and all the preparation time. And then when Jesus comes, and then the explanation about what it meant that he came in the epistles. So the whole thing is about Jesus. But I wonder how many of us would be able to just share the gospel. Now, you may not be able to take them through Genesis to Revelation, but you have experienced something. You've experienced forgiveness in Jesus. You have a testimony if you've been touched by him, if he's come into your life, if you opened your heart to him. And you can share, very simply, what it was that you did to become a Christian. Now, it's not about coming down the aisle. It's about the heart that's open to the Lord. Coming down the aisle is that public profession to make it concrete in your heart and mind. And at the end of our message tonight, I'm going to ask that of some of you. If you want to know Jesus as your personal Lord and Savior, I'm going to give you that opportunity to make that a public profession. But can you answer that? You know, we all have two vocabularies, the words you recognize in a sentence and the words that you can recall and use in a sentence. Those are the words you really understand. When you can use them, now you've got them. And that's why I think, in many respects, when it comes to dealing with people, we need to put to practice. And some people just, they feel they lack people skills. But I want to encourage you. If you're not disadvantaged at all, I used to think it was a great disadvantage to be a little more introverted. Because I was by nature. And I thought, oh, I wish I had that gift of gab and that extrovert, you know, that person that can just like totally set people at ease and, you know, get an attention of a group, and just they really had that knack. That wasn't me. But you know what? You can be encouraged in this because your sensitivity, your empatheticness, you know, sort of thing, sometimes freezes you because you're turning it inward and you need to turn it outward. That same gift that makes you sensitive, which sometimes makes people shy, you should turn it away from yourself onto others, and it's an incredible gift as you can empathize where people are. You can touch people more deeply than all the extroverts, even if you are an introvert. You can have a greater impact. You're not disadvantaged. You know, for us, getting people's attention in Union Square was quite a challenge, and yet, again, the key was for us to just build a bridge. We found that most people were not interested in receiving a tract. And there were many people eager to give out tracts. But most of the people were not into it. They just felt accosted. They felt like a project. What we found is just sitting down and listening to them, 90% listening, 10% speaking. And once you heard their story, you know, you could leave them with something that after they felt they got a little bit about you, and they felt comfortable with you. One woman said to Brian Broderson, you know, when he was done talking with her, he wanted to give her one of the books that we had. And she says, I'm only going to take this because I like you and I believe you're sincere. And that's true for many people. They don't want to just receive something. It's kind of an affront. You know, when you're walking down New York, they hand you stuff. You don't know if it's a porno advertisement or if it's what. I don't like to receive anything. And that's the feeling people have about receiving things. They don't know what they're going to be accosted with. But when they see you as a real individual, and really that's what Jesus does, he elevates her in such an amazing way here. He steals her attention by asking the simple question, give me a drink. All that is in that one statement, give me a drink. Well, then she answers, of course, how is it that you, being a Jew, ask a drink from me, a Samaritan woman? She's shocked, she's surprised, so the door's open to go to the next level. And Jesus answers and says to her, if you knew the gift of God and who it is who says to you, give me a drink, you would have asked him and he would have given you living water. Jesus is amazing in this respect. He studied in every avenue into the human heart and arrives at the most likely a way to arouse her interest, or in this sense, he has her interest at this point. Because he said, if you knew the gift of God and who it is who speaks to you, give me a drink, you would have asked him. I'm asking you for water, but if you knew who I was, you'd have asked me for something quite different, this gift of God that I have. Well, the woman, of course, is quite amazed. She says, sir, you have nothing to draw with, and the well is deep. Where then do you get that living water? You know what I love about this aspect of Jesus offering living water is that now he is appealing to something in the Eastern mind that we may not appreciate as much, but they loved enigmas. They loved puzzles. They loved little mind games. So he's speaking cryptically. If you knew the gift of God, who it is who says to you, give me a drink, you'd have asked him and he would have given you living water. He's speaking cryptically, purposely, because in that culture, that was, first again, he's honoring her by giving her an opportunity to express, to ask questions, to engage in conversation. All this is happening in that culture. He's not giving off airs of superiority in any way, shape, or form. And, you know, and that's sometimes what happens when we approach people with our truth, what God has done in us. We don't know we're doing it, but we come off that way. And just because we're coming off that way just means we haven't studied our culture enough to know how we're coming off. And to take the sensitivity and the time to, you know, speak with people and to understand where they're coming from. It's about people. God has created us as people, not robots. Everyone is not the same. There's one size doesn't fit all. And Jesus takes the time with this one individual woman. Here's a person who can speak to 10,000 on the hill. He can go and he can preach to thousands, and here he is taking the time very patiently, blessing this woman, honoring her, making her day just by speaking with her. And especially now that he's giving this little cryptic thing, you know, she's very intrigued by this. And of course, she asks the next question, you have nothing to draw with, and the well's deep. Where are you going to get that living water? Now, she's replying cryptically back to him. It doesn't come out very clear in this. But when she says, are you greater than our father Jacob who gave us the well and drank from it himself as well as his sons and his livestock? She's saying, you know, I can give you some water. You're telling me about living water. And that sounds to be much greater. Obviously, it's not the water we're talking about here because you don't have anything to draw with. So what is you talking about? In other words, she's cryptically throwing it back to him. And I love this. He has her interest. There's certain truths that people just, they can't learn from someone else. They have to learn and discover for themselves. That's what makes this statement so amazing. Jesus is letting the woman get involved in the search. He's not just coming right off and saying, look, you know, I don't have much time. The guys are coming back with food. I'm the Messiah. Believe me, or you're toast. He's really engaging with her, and you know, and I love it. I used to admire the bold courage of street corner preachers, and I'm sure there's a place for that. But you know, in many ways, I see it as a lazy way to approach ministry. It's easy just to go out there and start yelling and spouting and speaking truth without having to take any bit of time to understand the individuals that are coming across your path. Jesus didn't do that. You know, when he would teach on the hill, it was, you know, people were hungering after that. They were thirsting after what he had to say. The teaching was good. It drew them rather than repelled them. Sometimes we can get very insensitive. you know, because we've just got a point to get across. And we don't take the time with people. There were problem areas we saw when we were in New York City. You know, I felt certain things we were doing we had to be careful of. In that context where the mourning was going on, to have these emblazoned Christian t-shirts at that time, it was kind of offensive. To pass out tracts or to even pray in public and make people feel like, well, you're a group and you're going to go out now and project them. And I found that, you know, tracts can be a great tool. As many of you have discovered, we've got a tract, you know, rack that you can take things and use them. But I think every tract needs to be individualized. It needs to be something that you need to pray about that opportunity and that right place and time to either leave one or to speak with someone and leave them with one, just like Jesus models. Again, another reason why I think this is amazing is because just like Paul the Apostle, he was a bold apostle, fiery preacher. But look how he goes into a city. Watch closely in Acts. You don't see him on the street corner yelling. You see him going into the synagogue because that's what he was familiar with. He was familiar with that culture. He built a bridge there. If there were no synagogues in the city, if they didn't have at least 10 Jewish males in the city, they wouldn't have a synagogue. He would go to the place where the public areas were and begin just conversing with people, looking for open doors, being sensitive. And even remember when he told the Thessalonians, he said, "You remember how I came among you as a mother, you know, nursing her chicks," very gently, as a nursing hen, not a nursing hen, nursing mother. Or a hen, either way. You can kind of mix the metaphor there. I don't think hens nurse, do they? Well, when he came to Philippi, it was a similar thing. It was like he was sensitive. He went down by the river and he met this lady, Lydia, and it said the Lord just opened her heart to hear the things he had to say. And he'd start with that building block, with individuals, very, very sensitively, as bold as he was. Well, Jesus, you know, the woman now, her interest is, you know, there, and she wonders what's going on and waiting for him to explain himself. And Jesus then answers and says, "Whoever drinks of this water will thirst again. But whoever drinks of the water that I shall give him will never thirst. But the water that I shall give him will become in him a fountain of water springing up into everlasting life." Now he's getting a little more plain in the sense of his authority and who he is. It's still a little cryptic, but it's obvious now he's speaking about true thirst. You drink of this water, you're going to thirst again. Now, sometimes you can do that with someone that's going to the drinking fountain in a public place. You say, you know, if you drink of that water, you're going to get thirsty again. But I know of water that you'll never get thirsty again. Now, you could do that, but in this culture, it would probably fall flat. Just wouldn't fly. People would really start, they'd be looking at you and grabbing their purse and running away if necessary, you know, but they wouldn't know what to expect from that because it's a different culture. In that culture, of course, it's hitting the mark. Now, we know what he's talking about. We see, he says, "Whoever drinks of this water I'll give him will never thirst." What is that? It's not just water that you could find. It's not Ponce de Leon who's going to go and find the fountain of life, the water of life that once he drinks he'll have eternal life. It's a real thirst, but it's not a physical thirst. And that real thirst we all have. And this woman has, and of course we're going to find she's been very thirsty. Because she's been around and she's tried many things to fill her life with. She's had many men in her life. It hasn't satisfied her. She's been very, very thirsty. And that's what he's driving at here. And that's why, you know, this door has opened. And you know, when Paul the Apostle prayed for a door to open, here he was, as bold as he was, but praying, "Lord, just give me a door, an open, effectual door." Because anyone, again, can just go preach. But to have an effectual door and to take advantage of a conversation the Lord is just using and being sensitive. And even while you're speaking to someone, you're praying, "Lord, give me wisdom, give me words." And so he starts hitting home with this woman. "The water I'll give him will become in him a fountain of water springing up into everlasting life." Now, it's not just interest. Her desire is aroused. Verse 15, she says, "Sir, give me this water, that I may not thirst nor come here to draw." She stays with the thought of drawing water. But understand, in that culture, she wasn't stupid. She knows he's talking about something much deeper. And she wants it. She's very intrigued by him. Here is this man who's honored her. He's treated her as an equal. He's respected her greatly. But now she's got some challenging thoughts. You know, this man is different from most I know. I want what he has. He's different. He's got something. And I want that. Jesus then says to her, "Go call your husband and come here." This always intrigued me. You know, if God is going to minister to our thirst, why not just minister to the thirst? And Jesus does say, you know, "I will give him of the fountain of life freely to him who thirsts." The Bible speaks about, you know, he says in Isaiah 55, verse 12, "Ho, everyone that thirsts, come to the water, come buy and eat. You who have no money, come freely. Why do you spend your money for that which is not bread and your wages for that which doesn't satisfy?" He says, "Listen carefully to me and eat what is good and let your soul delight itself in abundance." This is God's invitation. You know, with all the bridge building and sensitivity, however, you have to get to the point. And this is what Jesus is doing now. Before someone can really understand how that water of life can benefit them, they need to see very clearly why they need that water of life. You know, Christ is the answer, but that doesn't make sense to people who don't have the question. They don't have the understanding of why they need salvation, why they need his sacrificial death on the cross. So Jesus is now getting the woman's attention about her personal life, but he does it in such a sensitive way. "Hey, all right, go call your husband and come here." Well, the woman says, "Well, I have no husband." And now Jesus lowers the boom. He says, "You have well said, I have no husband, for you have had five husbands, and the one whom you now have is not your husband, and that you've spoken truly." Oh. He's earned the right to get this personal. We may not see it in that culture that clearly, but he really has earned the right to get that close and personal with her. And she's, of course, responding like anyone would respond in that point when now the spotlight is on a little too bright in your own personal choices in life. She says, "Sir, I perceive you're a prophet." You know, she's going to get into changing the subject. But what is the reason here Jesus does this? Why is he saying, "Go call your husband"? Sin is very subtle. When we're young, we think that we've got it under control. It's attractive, it's fun, and we have little desire for God because we're just distracted by the pleasures, the passing pleasures of sin. As we get a little bit older, though, we get burned a few times, we're a little more apt to look up to God. It's very crucial times in our life. Sometimes it's during the teenage years when you have a lot of questions floating in your mind about life and meaning, and you're very open at that point. If you bypass that point, then you get into when you get married, and sometimes you have marriage difficulties, and it makes you search again. "Lord, what is it about? Why am I here? What is my purpose in life?" And if you bypass that point and you get to the point where you have kids, then you begin to think as they start growing up, "How am I going to train them? What should I teach them about God?" And you begin thinking again a little bit more. And there's certain times in our life where we begin to really think and to look up and realize maybe there's something more. But if we don't respond to that, once sin sets in and you get set in your ways, eventually you don't ask those questions anymore. And it gets harder and harder for you to have that responsiveness to the Lord. Well, the law, that is what God requires of you, is the Bible says it's like a tutor to lead us to Christ. When we feel the pangs of guilt because we've failed to do what we know is right, that is a sign to us we don't have it all together like we thought. We want to pretend in front of people we do. We want to make it seem everything is fine. I'm doing good. I'm okay. You're okay. We're all okay. That's what we want to live with. But we're not really being honest because I'm not okay. There's something amiss. The thing that I want to do, I end up not doing. The thing that I don't want to do, that I end up doing. What wretched person I am. Why do I do this? Those are the little signs that when we feel that pangs of guilt upon us, from knowing what we've done is wrong. Now, the woman had settled at this point. After having five men in her life, she'd pretty much given up the thought about there being, you know, any salvation for her or any possibility of getting religious, because she basically broken all the rules. There was no going back for her. But Jesus now is kind of maybe bringing a little more of those thoughts to her surface again, really feeling a little bit more aware of, you know what, I am living wrong. And that's why he does this. She does what we would do. She changes the subject. She turns it to religion very quickly. She starts talking about, I perceive you're a prophet, and our fathers worshipped on this mountain, and you Jews say in Jerusalem is the place to worship. She's talking a mile a minute. I can just see it. And she just, you know, wants to change that subject real quick. You know, back to religion. Nice, safe subject. Jesus said to her, woman, believe me, the hour is coming when you and neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem worship the Father. In Jerusalem was the place to worship God. In the Old Testament, that was very clear. But Jesus is saying, an hour is coming when you will neither worship on this mountain nor in Jerusalem. You worship what you do not know. We know what we worship, for salvation is of the Jews. That is a very clear statement. God chose to send salvation through the Jews. Now, he's going to get to the point of that, but notice what he says. He has to correct, but not overcorrect. You know, there's sometimes we feel we've got to correct people all the time with their theology. Some things are not that important to deal with at that point. Jesus doesn't get into all the issue of all the little nuances between the Samaritan's belief and the Jewish belief. He just basically says, you know, we know what we worship. But the hour is coming. And he basically backs and says, the hour is coming and now is when true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth. For the Father is seeking such to worship him. Now, in that statement alone, Jesus is giving this woman an indication that God is seeking her. The Lord is seeking such worshipers. I've talked to you. I've spent time with you. You know I've honored you. You know I don't have any things up my sleeve here, no ulterior motive. I'm telling you, God is looking for such to worship him. God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship him in spirit and in truth. Now the woman gets very pertinent with her question. She says, I know that Messiah is coming, who is called the Christ, and when he comes, he will tell us all things. It's a beautiful picture when we can talk about, I know it's going to happen, but it's not the real answer at this point, because we're still diverting. Some will say, well, you know, some person believes this and some person believes that. And I know eventually, you know, God's going to iron it all out. And I just believe this and God will accept me. What we're doing is basically what this woman is doing. We're basically saying, I know when it all comes to end, when the Messiah comes, when God comes back and we die, it's all going to be ironed out. He'll tell us everything we need to know then. What's that got to do with now? What does that have to do with now? Because the truth is, if you take the position that this woman is taking right now here and just say, well, I know when the Messiah comes, he's going to tell us all things. In other words, it's not going to have any effect on my life right now because I can't know it at this point. And so when it happens, and then I'll get my act together. A lot of people take that position. But they don't realize that God is interested in now. Not what you did yesterday and all of your failures. And not what you might do in the future. Right now, where are you? Have you understood the truth of the gospel? Jesus said to her, I who speak to you am he. He introduces himself now. He explains the gospel. He reveals. So he stole her attention. He had her interest. He aroused her desire. He revealed the sin. And now he explains the gospel, the truth about who he is. You know, when you take those little headings together, you see the word share. Stealing the attention, has interest, arousing desire, revealing sin, and explaining the gospel. If you ever want to think about sharing the gospel, just think of that share. What Jesus did in this model. You know, her sarcastic veneer has been dropped. She leaves her water pot, you know, and she goes to the city to share with others. It we'll see amazingly, and Jesus turns this into an object lesson that we will look at next time for the disciples. But I want you just to picture this meeting with Jesus. Look at him and his compassion, his patience, his mercy, his love. Elevating this woman, not condescending to her. He was condescending to her, but not in a condescending way. He was reaching way down to her, but making her feel like a value of worth, that the Father is seeking her to worship him. And do you know that God is seeking you to know him, to fellowship with him, that he might bestow upon you forgiveness and cleansing, that he might bestow upon you power to walk, to be free to be what he's created you to be, more than you've ever been before. The Lord is looking for such. One of the most puzzling things about Jesus and how he dealt with people is that in our previous chapter, we saw Jesus with Nicodemus, this religious ruler. And with the religious ruler, he talks about being born again. And with this woman of the street, he speaks about religion. I find that fascinating. Worship. He speaks about worship. I would think he would speak with a religious guy about worship and with this woman about being born again. But you know, he knows exactly what each of us need. He knows our hearts. He knows us much better than we know ourselves. He wants to do a work within us. And if you don't know him personally, now is the time for you to humble yourself. And like this woman whose salvation comes, Jesus, of course, wanted to reach this entire city. His disciples went into the city. We're going to see their ineffectiveness because they're going to come out with food. And that's okay. They wanted food. They went in for food. They came out with food. They missed everything else. Jesus sits there by a well with one woman and he reaches the entire city. And so often I think that when we look at how God wants to use us, you'd be amazed how he can use those little down-to-earth things if we're just open and sensitive. I want to be like Jesus more than ever when I read this chapter. I just want to see how he was with people. And this is my model for ministry, for personal ministry. It's my model. This is what I want it to be. And oh, to have the wisdom and insight that Jesus had. And you know what? The amazing thing is, he's given us of his Spirit. That you shouldn't even have to premeditate the words you're going to speak. He'll give them to you in the time you need them. When you're just sensitive to his leading. Because you can't prepare. You go out on the street, how can you prepare a little speech for someone out in the street? You don't know who you're going to speak to, where they're coming from, what their person. God has made each unique person. That's so amazing. And he knows what each of us need. And he can guide us individually with individuals to talk to them and minister to them about their need for salvation. If we will trust the Lord and just be led of him. And of course, the disciples will learn this in the next chapter, and it'll encourage us also as well. That the harvest is plentiful, but the laborers are few.